And good evening and welcome to our Spokane Public Radio Forum called Confronting Homelessness. We hope to have a thoughtful discussion tonight about the general problem in Spokane, how serious it is, what resources are available to help those in need, and what steps can be done to try to eliminate it. We also want to talk in some detail about the general issue of the shortage of affordable housing in our Spokane area and what steps can be taken to alleviate that as well. Last year, the Associated Press did a series of articles on the homelessness crisis on the West Coast, including cities like Seattle and Los Angeles. One of the main takeaways from that was that even in communities experiencing an economic boom like Seattle with its major businesses like Amazon or Microsoft, the homeless crisis is starting to hit epic proportions in those communities. And even people with full-time employment, many are living in their cars or tents. One question in mind with that is, with Amazon poised to build a center here and other expansion proposed for the West Plains and elsewhere, does economic prosperity bring with it a double-edged sword? Will new businesses also bring increased housing costs and even less housing options for those at the bottom of the economic ladder? If the average person can't afford a home, what's the effect on those in the lower income brackets? One recent study in Seattle found an increase of $100 in the median rent price corresponds to a 15% rise in the homeless population. We hope to hear from a few folks who have actually experienced or are currently homeless to put a personal face on the issue as well. In our community, many of us are literally just a few paychecks away from having few options before we find ourselves without a place to live. It's literally a case of there but for the grace of God go I. And it's all too easy to stereotype a homeless person when actually everyone's story is far more complex than that. Every homeless person, regardless of where they are in life, is a real living being that deserves respect. We want to thank our event donors, the Journal of Business, Numerica Credit Union, and Providence Health and Services, as well as City Cable 5. We have two panels tonight to discuss the issue, and I actually regret we were not able to make room for literally the dozens of people and organizations who work on this issue in the community. There are a number of them. Tonight's format is going to consist of me specifically asking questions of these panelists, and then we want to open it up to you to ask from the audience. And I can see we have a big crowd tonight, so it looks like we'll have some good questions out there. Now, you can either write your questions down on a card. Nisha from our staff over here can come and give you a card that you could write a question of, or if you'd like, you can come up and speak briefly at our podium, but I really ask that your comments be no longer than a minute or so because of the time constraints. And we've got these two panels and they're each an hour. In theory, I'd like to go about 40 minutes or so with questions, or maybe less. We'll see how it goes. I probably won't be able to get to all the questions for all the panelists, but we really want you guys to have a chance to ask the questions as well. So let's see. Now I have the panelists. I need to introduce them too. So in hour one, we have Dr. Bob Lutz from the Spokane Regional Health District, who is also on the Spokane Regional Board of Health for 8 years prior to being appointed to the health officer for Spokane County. We also have Kay Morano, an advocate for affordable housing, who is currently the executive director of the Spokane Low Income Housing Consortium. Also, similarly, Edie Rice Sauer, she's the executive director of Transitions, a local nonprofit that works to end poverty and homelessness for women and children in Spokane, and they also have transitional housing for folks. They've also done these small cottages. We did a story on that on Spokane Public Radio, you may have heard in recent weeks. And then representing the city, Tim Sigler, senior manager for the Community Housing and Human Services Department for the city. Tim's professional experience includes working, he earned a master's degree in social work and has also served in non-traditional social work roles like a probation officer for problem solving the courts. So I've got to get a little water here because that was like a speech. Thanks for bearing with me on that. I want to start with Tim because the city does this homeless count every year and they've been doing it for a few years. Can you give us maybe some of the numbers? And I understand that the most recent count was done a month or two ago, but the data is still being compiled. But maybe give us an idea of the general nature of the problem and if the numbers are showing any improvement in recent years.
Sure. So, you're correct. About in mid-April is when we'll be releasing this year's point in time count data. We're still going through some of it to make sure that what we're sending out is accurate. I did bring some of the research that we had and presentations from last year, which is all available on the city's website in the Community Housing and Human Services Department. What we can say is that the numbers weren't drastically higher or lower, but what we've noticed is that it's different. We're exiting a lot more people, especially in the past 3 years, out of homelessness and into permanent housing, but we're having just as many people coming into the system that may not have been there before.
What did the most recent numbers from last year show? Do you know the overall count? Or
Yes, and I have a lot of different things on here I could share, but so this came out last year. It says 1,245 people were experiencing homelessness across Spokane community. Of that total, 200 were in transitional housing, 735 were in emergency shelters, and 310 were unsheltered.
How does that compare with numbers from previous years? In other words, is there any kind of trend that's showing it increasing or decreasing, or what?
There's increases and decreases, but really it's within that 1,000 to 1,500.
And was there's some sort of change in the methodology that you've been using in the last year to try to improve the count? In other words, I was curious about, you know, maybe if folks missed the count because they're living in cars, or could you just give us an overall view of how you have maybe changed the method of the count?
Sure. So one thing is last year we went from paper. So for the volunteers that were doing the count, we went from paper to using tablets. Just to be able to get that data right into the system, into the homeless management information system, to make it easier for both of the people doing the count, but also for our HMIS team to look at that as quick as we could to get the information out as soon as possible. A couple other things that we've done is really tried to increase the amount of survey locations. So this year we surveyed at 211 locations. That's throughout the county, and that's including rural areas that you wouldn't normally think that the city would be going out to. Mm-hmm. And we had over a third more volunteers this year that came out, which is great because the more people we have out there counting, the more accurate numbers we can get. Mm-hmm. The other side of that, though, is this is just a snapshot. So this is, you know, the 1 day, 1 week review. Things can change over time. So we're using that really to inform decisions that we're making and to inform interventions in the future based off of that local data that we have.
Okay. I think to get another overall look at the problem, I want to talk to Kay a little bit about the housing crunch. Mm-hmm. And we realize the homelessness issue has a lot to do, obviously, with people's income and the like, but it also has a lot to do with the seriousness of how many homes are available in Spokane, even if we're just talking about the overall number of homes for rent. But could you give us some details or maybe some little factoid numbers?
Absolutely.
Or something, Kay?
Well, currently, one of the biggest issues is the fact that the vacancy rate in Spokane is just under 2%. And that's not just for affordable housing, that's for any housing. So any person who's saying, my rent's getting a little expensive, I'm going to see if I can find someplace else that I can afford to live, can't find someplace else, period. And so folks are on waiting lists for months. And by months, I mean 8, 10, a year to try and get into another location because there just isn't enough availability for what they're looking for. We also know that half of the renters in Spokane County are paying more than the recommended 30% to keep a roof over their head. They're paying it for their rent. Half of our renters. That's really way too high a number to be saying, I don't have money to go to other things. And honestly, 25% of those renters are paying half their income just for rent. So when you couple the fact that they're paying too much and they can't afford other things with the fact that they can't afford to leave where they are because they can't find another location, it puts them in a real bind and it shows us just how short we are on the amount of housing that we need. And unfortunately, it creates bottlenecks because you have people who go through great programs to try and say, you know, I'm ready to be stable and I want to have housing. I can't move from a shelter to someplace else, which means that shelter bed is still being taken, so someone on the street can't move into that shelter bed, and it bottlenecks all the way back. And so we need housing at all levels. We need senior housing, we need assisted living, we need medical assistance, all of these things pieced together, and we need it all.
And we've got a realtor coming up in the second half that we can ask a little more about efforts, in part in Olympia. They're trying to work on some bills to increase the housing options here, but, and I may just venture this to the panel, but we can always, we can ask Tom Hormel this question too, and he's the realtor. But, you know, when we hear that more businesses may be coming to Spokane, like the Amazon thing, I mean, does that concern you when we think of just maybe the housing in Airway Heights, for example? I mean, or just the entire area if we get a lot more economics coming in or economic boom?
Definitely, it's a challenge because, I mean, more than just housing. You have to have the infrastructure to build more housing. We know that Fairchild is expanding. They're talking about bringing more families in there. They have jobs. They're ready to, you know, already being employed, but we don't have any place for them to live. So do they add into the very little vacancy that we have in Spokane? How far away from that base can they get and still be able to maintain that as their work location? Yes, having Amazon, they said, we're going to bring in jobs, but we're going to hire local people. At the same time, I also know that there was an apartment building out in Airway Heights that during January through June of last year, when it was speculation about what Amazon was going to be building, the rent was increased in that building 3 times because they said, oh, Amazon's going to come when they, you know, something's happening. And then it's, oh, it's Amazon. Mm-hmm. No one can afford 3 rent increases in 6 months. They were already living at the very border of what they could afford.
And when we're talking about this, you know, there may be homeless folks in our audience or people hearing this in the air later that think, well, you know, I can't even really afford anything at all. So why are you talking about housing? But could you maybe, you know, talk about the importance of just the general thing about the whole housing issue that would have a trickle down effect to folks?
Absolutely. We know that from the National Low Income Housing Alliance's Out of Reach report for 2018, that at minimum wage, you would need to work 93 hours a week to afford a 2-bedroom apartment. So if you're a single parent with a kiddo, you're having a really hard time paying for that apartment. You have to work 75 hours for a 1-bedroom apartment. And what that boils down to essentially is, if you weren't making minimum wage, to afford that 2-bedroom apartment, you would need to make $26.87 an hour to be able to keep it below that 30% threshold, that 30% of your income is going to go to your roof, keeping a roof over your head. That's the 8th highest housing wage in the nation. Washington is a very expensive place to live. Fortunately, we have a good economy and people are able to get jobs, but that's not as statewide as the cost of the housing. So we realize that, as I said, it all builds on itself as far as that housing is for all different. It's family housing out in neighborhoods, it's apartments, it's senior housing. All of those things compound the issue because we need it all and have a shortage of it all. And unfortunately, it does trickle then back into homeless services as well.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you in a moment about this nonprofit developers, but I thought I'd ask some questions of Edie. So your organization, Transitions, you were kind enough to invite me up there and see the cottages and the like, but do you want to maybe give our audience an overview of what it is that Transitions does and what the transitional housing means?
Okay. Transitions is a local not-for-profit. It was actually started by 4 Catholic sponsoring communities. They came together in 1995. So we provide transitional housing. We provide the New Leaf Bakery, which is a job training program in the culinary arts. Women's Drop-In Center, Women's Hearth, is a day center for women on 2nd Avenue. And I always say that's for all women. I might want to use the classes there, but 60% of the people that we serve there are women who are in shelters or living on the street. And we also have a child care center. Transitional housing is an interesting niche that's been much maligned, actually, in the recent past. It's a 2-year limit on housing. It's generally seen as a place for people to go so that they can learn some skills, maybe connect with employment possibilities, tie into a case manager, get a little more stable, and then move on to housing, permanent housing. But it's also recognized as a best practice for people who are domestic violence survivors and sexual assault survivors. So it's a really good place for people who are maybe have just gotten away from an abuser, but have stabilized a little bit and are ready to move into housing, where then they can get those skills ready so that they can move into housing.
Okay. You know, I want to take a real quick break here. And Loretta, do you want to come up and talk for just a sec? Now, Loretta is somebody that has experienced the homeless issue. Can you come up here? I thought that this would be a good time to just have you give kind of a very brief version of what you've experienced. I didn't want to just have the panelists, the experts talk, but I thought it'd be useful if we just had at least a couple people that have actually gone through it.
Okay.
You had some unfortunate circumstances that ended up with you being homeless for a period, correct?
Well, I flew from a domestic violence situation about a year and 3 months ago, and I flew from that situation into caring for my mother. She was in her terminal stages. So I took off to California, and I was homeless in a tent. I lived in a tent and in my car for 8 months until she passed away. Mm-hmm. And then I was lucky enough to have known some people out here that I volunteered for in the past that called me out here and gave me a place to stay. But, I mean, I never saw myself becoming homeless. And but I'm lucky enough that I had the strength to leave that relationship because my mother was dying. I have my degree from UC Berkeley, my bachelor's degree, and I'm an educated, well-spoken person. But yet I found myself to be in that situation.
And how long were you homeless for in this time frame? Maybe two different time frames, but so overall.
So that was about 10 months, almost a year. So I left here Christmas, and I went out to California, and I was homeless. And I cared for her until August 1st. She passed away. And then I found myself back over here by October.
And just maybe kind of a brief synopsis of what it was like. I mean, you're a woman and you were out on the streets dangerous, and you were had.
And it is, really scary for your safety and being in positions where people try to take advantage of you. And it's really hard to get on your feet when you're just thinking about like first month's rent, deposit and all that. And I don't have any children, but I do have two small dogs and I consider them my therapy dogs. I haven't yet seen a doctor about that, but it was just about impossible for me to find housing that would take me and my dogs and where I'd have enough. Like I got up to $1,400 in cash and I was unable to still have enough to put down to find a place. So I had to worry about my personal safety. So it becomes when you're in that situation, it becomes the day-to-day struggle and survival versus planning, trying to plan for finding a house or home, you know, some stable housing. Mm-hmm. So it turns into, what am I going to eat today? Where am I going to park my car that I'm not going to get harassed? Or where am I going to be able to put up my tent so that I can be safe tonight? And that kind of, you know, takes over.
It's weary making.
Yeah, so just that day-to-day thing, it would be very difficult for you to even try to maybe make arrangements to talk to some of these counselors or people, agencies that could help you, because it would be tough to do. I mean, did you have a phone or?
I did have a phone, but I mean, there's a certain amount of embarrassment, and it makes it a little bit harder for you to reach out and for help when you're in that stage. It's hard to ask for help when you've been on the other end of that and you've been a provider where you've been a resource for somebody else in the past. So I think that there was the level of embarrassment, and then also just being able to literally, for example, to come here today, I had to pay for parking.
Mm-hmm.
And say I didn't have that money, how would I, you know, just even thinking about that when you're going and looking for help, things like that come up and it gets discouraging. So it's easy for it to be challenging on other levels as well.
Okay. I think that works. And maybe someone will ask you a question from the audience. I don't know.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Hey, Edie, you know, in her case, I'm just trying to think, if somebody hears this on the air or in the audience and they think, God, this is my similar position, I mean, and maybe this is for Kay too. I mean, what do you recommend somebody do mm-hmm. when they find themselves in this kind of situation? Who do they talk to initially?
Well, we want people to be in a safe situation. So I think the first call would be to like the YWCA, or if you're a sexual assault survivor, to Lutheran Community Services Northwest. We know that we have limited sheltering availability for domestic violence survivors, which is a real challenge, but there is some. There's some here and also outside of the county.
Mm-hmm.
We have a local federal grant that provides transitional housing for domestic violence and sexual assault survivors, and so those people can go through Lutheran and YW and they'll get referred to us for housing.
And Kate, I mean, part of your gig is just finding people housing options. Do you want to just maybe give a brief bit about that?
Really, it's trying to pass on information about where they can go and how do they start that process. Because if they're not in a domestic violence situation and they're just saying, I'm trying to find a place to rent, where do I look? Because mm-hmm. there is no one master list. There's no one place that you can go and say, what are all the apartments in Spokane and which ones can I afford? So it's a challenge. If they're currently experiencing homelessness, they can go through both SNAP for singles, Catholic Charities for Homeless to go into the coordinated assessment programs. Obviously, we have the Housing Authority that has a lot of different housing. 211 is a good resource as well, just to try and say, here's what my situation is. Sometimes you don't even know what to ask as far as what do I need. But, you know, they can start to ask those questions of, have you eaten? Do you know where to find your next meal? Where are you going to sleep tonight? And to try and walk through what are the concerns that you need to be addressing, because oftentimes when you're in that situation, all you're thinking about is, what am I going to do? And it's really hard in that particular moment to plan out a future when you can't think past 5 minutes from now, what is the first step and who do I contact? So, and they can contact me as well to try and say, where do I go? And that's one of the big parts of my job, is just to refer people to the people that would be able to help what their situation is.
Okay, and it's easy to find a way to contact you?
I actually am at slihc.org, and okay. That's Spokane Low Income Housing Consortium, but oh, yes.
Okay, and I'm starting to kind of go through these cards. I'm glad you talked a long time, because I have to try to read these handwriting here. It's kind of hard. But this one might be good for you, Kay, or whomever, but and then Dr. Lutz, I'm going to get to you in a sec. Sorry, you're sitting there. It says here, what is the plan for being able to rent an apartment when you have a felony? Could you guys address that at all? Is that a... It's got to be a difficult
Tough.
Situation.
Yeah, unfortunately, we all shook our heads. I don't know if you saw that, but yeah. Right now it is really hard to find housing in that situation, because it is one of the things that people can say, you know, depending on what that felony is, it's not safe for our building, we won't have you here. There are some organizations in Spokane that are specifically working on how do we do felony housing, and is that the best model? Should it be all felons in one place, or should they be, you know, scattered throughout the community so that we don't have a concentration. Pioneer Human Services does a lot of felony housing. Another group, I Did the Time, has started to actually do their own houses, because they realized when they were trying to refer services and have people go in other directions, they weren't being helped. So they said, you know what, we're going to step up and we'll do it ourselves. So it's a big, big challenge right now. Fortunately, there are some folks that really want to tackle it, but the need is great.
Dr. Lutz, I should ask you some questions here. And, you know, we had a little pre-interview. You told me a little bit about some research that had been done to look at how the environment someone had been raised in can often play a role in their development in terms of those that might be prone to wind up homeless. And I guess I should clarify this too, and I wanted to ask the group this, and I'll ask both groups. We may be talking in this case of what some refer to as chronically homeless, and I don't even know how we define that, and maybe I'll throw that open to you guys if you wanted to define it. In other words, let me ask that question first to the group. Is there there's got to be a difference between someone who, you know, is chronically homeless and maybe they don't want to help themselves get out of the situation, as opposed to maybe someone like Loretta who just suddenly things took a turn for the worse and they find themselves in this situation. Can you talk about that for a sec, and then I'll ask Dr. Lutz about his research?
Well, I'll start. Basically, yeah. HUD defines what a person who is considered chronic homeless is. So it's so many times within a period of time. And so that's a certain population of people who are homeless. They can be men, women, women with children. It can be really a diverse population, but it's very defined by HUD.
I see. Well, Dr. Lutz, do you want to talk about that for a sec, about these environmental forces that could lead people to kind of be more prone to that?
Sure, Steve. I think, you know, what you're alluding to and what we in public health are very much aware of is what are referred to as adverse childhood experiences. And as the literature grows, we're finding that these ACEs are involved with just a host of issues, from acute to chronic medical problems to, again, increasing your risk for homelessness. So what is an ACE? Imagine, if you will, that you're a child and you find yourself in a home environment that's maybe very unstable. Maybe you are yourself experiencing violence, or you're watching violence take place in your house. Okay, drug usage, divorce, all these stressors are impacting a child and infant's brain that is rapidly taking in and growing. But imagine that that brain and that young child is being surrounded by this stressful environment. And that chronic stress, you know, we're all familiar with the fight or flight mechanism. Imagine that you're on that chronic fight or flight 24/7, 365. And so what the research is showing is that when children are exposed to those adverse childhood experiences, it impacts their life course. And so with respect to homelessness, if you have, as a child, been exposed or have an ACE count of 8, so you've watched violence, you've experienced violence, there's drug usage in the house, parents divorced, what have you, the likelihood of you experiencing homeless sometime as an adult is roughly 33%. So imagine that we're talking about something that's happening at the childhood level, at the infancy level, that's impacting that individual's life course trajectory. I mean, that's, so in public health, we talk about the social determinants, we talk about going upstream. And homelessness, I would argue, is at some level an outcome, but to really impact homelessness is prevention. And prevention is looking at those upstream causes that then allow someone that trajectory to find themselves in a homeless situation.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit then about the specific health threats that homeless folks might face? I mean, I'm guessing it's a wide array of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, if you look at it from a health standpoint, health issues, and as we've heard, health issues can cause someone to become homeless just because they have a significant health event that then they can't afford, they find themselves unable to pay the bills, they find themselves homeless or having unstable housing. Conversely, imagine, if you will, that you have a chronic medical condition. Imagine that you have diabetes and you require insulin. How are you going to be able to maintain your insulin if you're out on the street? Okay, so we see this bi-directional issue where individuals who are homeless have more problems with existing chronic medical conditions and psychiatric conditions, and conversely, those individuals who may have medical issues may find themselves homeless, and it's this sort of perpetual cycle that, again, makes it very challenging for individuals.
Mm-hmm. This was a question from the audience, and actually it was something I had written on my list too, but do you know, is there a fatality rate among the homeless population, or do we have data for that at all? Or
yeah, that's an, I actually looked into this, and there is an ICD-10 code that is sometimes used, but I looked at the data for last year and I couldn't find any specific reference to death by homelessness. Unfortunately, we know, however, that people do die on the street, and they definitely die at higher rates of some of these issues. I mean, we know that, unfortunately, people who are on the street are more susceptible to violence committed against them, and we've seen that locally. So again, I think that although we may not have specific statistics around that, we know it exists.
Okay. Hey, Tim, I want to ask you a little bit then about more about the city's efforts to deal with this. So I understand there's this new Envision Center, and it's sort of being touted as a one-stop shop for folks to provide services. Could you just give us an overview of what that is exactly?
Sure. And the name is actually the Spokane Resource Center. It's a designation Envision Center through HUD. Just to give a little history behind that, this wasn't a new concept. This has actually been around since the Blueprint for Reform was done regarding criminal justice reform many years ago. And out of that, one of the recommendations for the reform is to have what they called an integrated social services pilot project. So that is a, like you had said, it's a wraparound services type facility. So you can go there for mental health, substance use, pre-employment, employment, and there's a long list of things actually that you can go there for. And so really what happened in the last several years with the Regional Law and Justice Council is that it has transformed into something completely different, and then the city grabbed onto it and said, okay, well, we're going to move forward on this because we've been talking about it for so many years in the Law and Justice Council for criminal justice reform that we just thought, now's time to move, because we've talked enough. We know what needs to be there, so let's secure a facility and start working with providers to get them into this area. And we can say one-stop shop. It's not going to solve all the problems, and we don't expect it to start off with. We're just trying to get the right providers in the building at the right time. So it's really not just a response for homelessness. There are homeless services there. It's a response to the community and the needs in the community. So whether that is people experiencing homelessness or maybe on the verge. You talked, Dr. Lutz had talked about diversion. That's really what the focus is on this center, is before you get to that situation, come here first, and maybe you can, maybe you don't even realize what you need. And by talking to some of the providers there, what you think you need over here, you actually need in another area that keeps you from becoming homeless or becoming part of the criminal justice system.
Now, tell me, why was it related to the law and justice thing? Does it have something, and I'm just going to ask this of you anyway, maybe because you worked in this field, but talk a little bit about this community court and what that is. Is this connected to it because of that? Is that what you mean? Or
I wouldn't say it's necessarily connected to it. I think there was the same idea in community court and also the same idea in the Veterans Court in Spokane, which mm-hmm. is provide services for a specific population in one area so that you don't have to go all over town to try and get to one appointment. We've had some statements for people who are experiencing homelessness that have said, I might be able to make it to one appointment today, a day, because I have to wait in line. If you think about going to some of the offices in town that you're going to get services for, maybe to get an ID card or get into some kind of disability assistance, you may be sitting in line for a couple hours, and then you have to take the bus to get there, or you might not have a bus pass. So it could really take you an entire day to get through one appointment. And so the idea, I would say, with community court, with the Veterans Court, and now with the Spokane Resource Center is to put all those in one area so that you can maybe hit two or three appointments in one day.
Okay. And so I think what I should do is back up a little bit and have you describe what the community court is. But when I want to ask you a question leading to that, too. A big controversy in Spokane has been this sit-lie ordinance. And I think it would be more appropriate to have someone from the city describe what that is. I know it was in effect and it was taken out of effect when there were no shelters for a while. But because many in our audience, when we broadcast this, may have no idea. They don't live in Spokane. They don't read our papers. Could you tell us just an overview of what is the sit-lie ordinance first?
Yeah, I can give a brief description. I think probably Councilwoman Burke would be best to speak on the
sure.
legislative side
and I'll
side
be asking
this.
Her the same thing.
Sure. So I believe it was enacted in 2013 or 2014, and it's not associated necessarily with community court. Community court was already in place before the sit and lie ordinance came
okay.
out. It's my understanding that there were issues in the downtown core area of people sitting or lying down in areas that were that some thought were causing issues for being able to access businesses or just being able to access the streets in general.
Mm-hmm.
That really has nothing to do with the department that I'm in, but that's, I believe, kind of what
okay.
what started that process
right.
for Sit and Lie.
So the description, though, of the community court, because this kind of ties in, when I visited Edie at Transitions, mm-hmm. We met a little gal who lived in one of their cottages, and I'll have you talk about that in a sec. But she said that she had kind of, essentially, she wound up in community court, but she did it on purpose. She said she went out and got arrested on purpose so she could get some help. But could you describe to folks what is the community court? You get in there, but it actually helps people, directs them to services that may help them for various problems.
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
It is, and so I will somewhat link it to the sit and lie ordinance as well as some other, they call it quality of life crimes. So if you get, let's say, ticketed for sit and lie while it's active, the response from police to begin with, and I don't know where it's at now, but to begin with is an officer makes contact with somebody, they let them know that there is a law against doing this, they're not going to cite them at that time, but if they come back later in the day and the person is still there, then they will cite them.
Mm-hmm.
They also let them know about the community court, and all of the downtown officers have flyers for community court, so they will hand those flyers to the person and say, if you need help or assistance, you can go to community court. You do not have to have a charge to go to community court either. If you want to participate in the court side of it, you do, but the resource center that's next to it is there for anybody in the general public that might need services.
Okay, and maybe at this opportunity, Edie, you can describe a little bit about the cottages. I mean, your group was able to put together kind of these small homes up mm-hmm. on the northwest side of town.
Well, the city has a cottage housing ordinance, and so we were able to use that to build these homes that are single family, and they're 1,000 square feet or less, so they're about 475 square feet to 1,000. And it's an infill project, so it was on 2 acres of land that we owned off of Northwest Boulevard. So there are 24 cottages and a community building, and there's a lot of rules within the city ordinance about it, although it's gotten a little less, it's a little more flexible now than it used to be. But it's a standalone home for people, and you know, I always think that many years ago when I was doing mental health work, we did a survey among people who were in mental health services to ask what they wanted for housing, and basically they said they wanted privacy, access to a grocery store, and transportation. And I don't know why that's so surprising to all of us. We all want that. So the cottages are a way of doing that. That provides them with their own unit, their privacy, they've got their own kitchen, their own bathroom, but they also then are living in community, so part of our work is to try to give them that support in that community.
And you started to say that you didn't have to get a special zoning permit. It was
no.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I wouldn't follow
well,
up on that.
Yeah, that area was zoned single family, and you know, we never consider putting a high rise in that area. It's a lovely neighborhood. We didn't really want to change it. To be honest, we were going to build 8 units. That was as much as we really wanted to tackle, but you really can't make it affordable. You can't pay for your case management if you only go with like 8 units. So we used the ordinance, built 24 of them, and are kind of learning to work with that. But I think in the end, we provided housing for a lot of people who never had ever thought they'd have their own home, and now they do.
Mm-hmm. And the follow-up, which I'll probably direct to Kate, because she's on the city council, is about, I saw a thing in the state legislature had passed some sort of a bill that would allow communities to decide if they wanted to build these tiny houses, mm-hmm. which are even smaller than your cottages. And yep. I know maybe this isn't your field of expertise, but do you see that as a future answer for the city of Spokane, where we could get these some areas specifically zoned to put in even tinier homes, just enough for people to put their stuff and maybe, you know, have a place to sleep?
Sure. I mean, there's a great example outside of Olympia, Coyote Village. That group actually designed their own village. They're small, tiny homes. I think they're generally around 12 by 12. They're not very big.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they have their own plumbing. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they have a community space. They usually have shared cooking facilities, and it varies depending on the site. But I think it's great for single people who need housing. I don't find it to be very effective for families, but for single folks, it's great. And then they do, in Coyote Village, they do their own governance.
And they had to get a special zoning permit or some
Probably.
Kind of variance. Yeah. And Kay, this goes hand in hand with Edie's thing, was because Edie used nonprofit developers to build this affordable housing. So, I mean, the overall question is, what does that mean? But are there more of those kind of projects that could be planned for Spokane?
Well, I'm going to broaden it out first, because nonprofit developers are doing all kinds of housing, and you know, whether they're looking at tiny houses, whether they're looking at apartment complexes, whether they're looking at single family, they have all of those options. And we have a lot of great developers here locally already. Catholic Charities is putting out housing regularly, Volunteers of America, Commonwealth Agency, Inland Empire Residential Resources, the Spokane Housing Authority, Spokane Housing Ventures, obviously Edie's Transitions Group. I mean, there's more, and they are all doing different types of housing, which is fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are some who definitely are looking at tiny houses. The Quixote Village actually was brought the four idea on how they wanted to do that, Community Frameworks was involved with, and they are local here in Spokane, but they work all across the state, and so they're looking at what are some possibilities that we could do here locally as well as others. But the question is, what's right for Spokane? And yes, we're talking about potential zoning changes for tiny houses, for height restrictions, for all sorts of different changes to add more infill, create more density, but at the same time help meet the housing need that we have so that it is easier to develop and we don't just keep sprawling further and further out and not have resources available to back that. So it has to be right for Spokane, and it has to be done in the right way. And like Edie said, you know, some of those for families, I know myself personally, I don't want to live in a tiny house with my daughter in Spokane and have to take her to the bathroom in the middle of the night in the snow that we have on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that as a functional thing to ask a mom to do. Some moms would say, I would rather do that than be in the tent that I'm in, and I would rather do that than be in the car that I'm in, because at least there is a bathroom. But at the same time, maybe we could do better and have a bathroom in the house. It adds to the cost, I get it, because you have to hook it up to plumbing. You have to consider other factors that add cost. But we need to decide what is right for Spokane and how do we meet the needs of the people that we're actually trying to serve, which is why we have to have them involved in that conversation.
Tim, that's out of your expertise, but you're with the city, and I was probably going to ask our city councilman that same thing about the tiny homes. Do you know much about that? And the other thing I would add, Seattle apparently did an experiment, and I'm not so sure it's been that successful, but similar kind of thing where they found areas that were parking, you know, for folks that were living in their homes or maybe older RVs and the like. I mean, are these options that you guys know might work for Spokane? And maybe that's better directed at our city council person, but
I can say that they are options. Our team has done a significant amount of research on tiny homes and different type homes like that. Mm-hmm. Part of the funding for the cottages came from the city of Spokane. So these are possibilities. We do have great nonprofits that can help support these. But if we need more funding, we need more projects to apply for that. So we just finished a five-year funding notice for the majority of our department's funds, and we didn't get any applications for tiny homes or any construction in that area. So We have to have the applications to come in to partner with those. Now, we do other projects with a lot of the agencies that you're talking about, but speaking on like a larger level of our five-year funding, we didn't get any applications for those.
Okay. Hey, Edie, a follow-up on that too, the final thing about the cottages. I asked you when you did it, I mean, this seems kind of like a money-losing venture, but you have had investors even that helped you do this. Maybe just talk a little bit about how did you finance these cottages? I mean, is that
okay.
A touchy question here? No.
Well, it's a tax credit project, so Catholic Charities is doing a lot of tax credit projects. That's what most of the funding is for these projects.
Right.
Our cottages, it was a $6.2 million budget. And basically, we had city money, we had private foundations, we had private donors. The state of Washington contributed dollars as well. But the major chunk of dollars is coming from an investor. That's PNC Bank.
Okay.
So, but the, you can't make this pencil, basically, unless you have some kind of investor. And we're doing what's called permanent supportive housing, so we want a case manager on site. So the only way to really afford that is to have some dollars coming in that we can use for that. And so part of that gets paid through the rents.
Okay. So you are charging a
yeah, everybody pays 30% of their income, just like Kay was talking about a 30% threshold. That's very typical. Most of us, that's what we're doing. And so people who, whatever they make, they pay 30% of their income for rent.
Okay. And I'm starting to get a lot of questions here, so I'm just going to ask a few of these, and then I'll open it up and see if anybody else wants to come down here and ask. And so these could be all over the map, because I'm trying to pre-read these when you guys are talking, and it's not that easy to do. But this one seems to fit what we were just talking about. So what gaps do you see in housing or homeless services offered in the city? And then they wrote, like, unaccompanied youth.
We have a lot of gaps. That's not one that I mentioned specifically, but we definitely need more housing for minors. And, you know, we have a system for shelter for that, but where do they go when they are able to leave the shelter, and what does that look like?
Renting to landlord often won't rent to somebody who's under 18. So that becomes a challenge too.
Yeah, another barrier to try and overcome. And they say, you know, I can be independent. I can't go back home. It's not a safe environment for whatever reason, but I don't have any options available to me because no landlord's going to rent to me when I'm 17. Seniors are another. Our population is aging. Most of the housing in our area doesn't include the things that you need as you age, with, you know, bathrooms that are wide enough to accommodate a wheelchair, or hallways or entrances that are all on one level so that you're not having to deal with ramps and things like that. It's definitely a gap. And we just have a huge shortage as well in affordable workforce housing. So, you know, the people that we're talking about saying we need more housing for, it's not entirely folks that are homeless that you're seeing that are sleeping out on the ground. It's also families who are working, and mom and dad are all in the family. They all have jobs, and they still can't afford to pay the rent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it really is all across the board that we do need more housing. But yeah, there are some areas that you were mentioning, you know, formerly incarcerated. There's no housing for them either. These are all big gaps.
And there was a follow-up, too. I should have thrown that out. What creative service models would you like to see to implement to address those issues? I mean, that could be anything. We started to talk about the little homes or the maybe people living in cars and stuff, but is there anything off the top of your head that you could add to that? Or,
you know, I mean, one gap I would say, too, that we did, that Kate had mentioned is domestic violence survivors. There's just, the shelter is always packed. That and what happens is when we finally get somebody out of shelter into transitional, it opens up one space or two spaces into shelter, but that's very challenging. Mm-hmm. I'd say that one of the models that I've seen done pretty well here is actually not-for-profits work really well together. So I think we try to not duplicate our efforts. For example, we have this federal grant, and it's not just us, but Lutheran, YW, and Transitions work together on this federal grant. And I think that's the kind of model we're talking about, is don't duplicate, try to bring your best skills forward and work as a team. And I think that we do that actually pretty well in Spokane.
Okay.
And I would add to that really those agencies do work well together, and they work with the housing authority as well to try and say, we have a limited amount of vouchers that can help assist with the rent so that the tenant only has to pay that 30%. And they're working with all those different agencies to say, how can we get these into your building to help the people that you have who need to be able to do that, as well as folks that are trying to go to them directly. But, you know, how do they make best use of that so that you're not just handing someone a voucher and saying good luck, but it comes with the services that these agencies can provide to make sure that they're going to have support when they need it.
When you mentioned the vouchers, I remembered there was something else to do with the legislature. Was it in the last year to do with requiring that landlords do rent to people with these vouchers? Could you elaborate on that a bit
for
a moment?
They passed a bill actually stating that you are no longer allowed to discriminate based on the source of income of the tenant. And what that really means is it doesn't matter how the rent gets paid, whether you pay it, whether the housing authority pays it, whether it comes from a HUD voucher, as long as the rent gets paid, you shouldn't be turned away because someone says, well, you know, I don't know if I want to take a housing voucher payment. And honestly, it came about because I don't want to take those people and I don't want to take poor people, which is most of us. We are all a paycheck away, an emergency away from needing that kind of assistance. So we were very fortunate that Spokane was one of the leaders in trying to get that change done, because they looked at their own legal code and said, you know, what is our discrimination code and who are we covering? And they realized that one of the things that wasn't in that had to do with source of income discrimination. And they changed that, and then we helped and they helped as they went to the state legislature to say, this is not just a Seattle issue. This is actually a statewide issue. And they had many examples of, you know, buildings who had said, you know, I'm sorry, we're no longer going to take your voucher. And they went into the building to say, okay, who are the tenants here? And the majority of the tenants were single moms of color. And they said, this is discrimination, flat and simple. We need to stop this. It is not acceptable. And they passed it on a statewide basis so that they are not able to discriminate based on the fact that you want to use a voucher. And fortunately, since the state did that, they also tried to include a carrot to say, we realize you think that there's a risk in trying to help someone who maybe doesn't have the same kind of resources available. So if that person with that voucher does damage to your unit, we will help fund to repair the damages up to $5,000 per incidence. Just to try and say, we don't think it's going to be a risk, but just because you think it's a risk, we want to make that available so that it eases the idea of, I can go ahead and accept these folks, instead of just trying to cram it down their throats and say, you have to take them.
The camping in the parks thing, this may be also directed at our city council person, because she's working on this issue, but apparently there was a court ruling, to do with Boise, Idaho, and they had outlawed camping in the parks there, but this court overruled that and said that practice could not be outlawed. But what's Spokane's policy on that now? I mean, that is that against the law to be camping in a city park right now, or?
My understanding, it was a federal issue.
Okay.
And so that was part of the impact of the warming centers, was that if you did not have availability of shelter for people, then you could be found at fault.
I see. But if you had a warming center, then
where there was availability, then you were okay.
And it was similar with the sit-lie in that same situation, that if you had a space for them to go to and they were not taking advantage of that, then you could cite them. But if you didn't have anywhere else for them to go, to make it a criminal offense to try and exist, that's what the court found was the problem.
Okay. Here is a question also about the warming centers. and hopefully I can read this properly. It says, why is there not a publicly funded day warming shelter where homeless citizens can go from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. when the night shelters are closed? In that way, they then have 24-hour warming shelters. And I'll ask this of the second group, too.
You get to start.
Anybody know?
Well, Women's Hearth is a publicly funded day center. It's open now 7 days a week. Yay. 8:30 to 4:30. So that's targeted towards women. And then House of Charity is open quite a bit of the time during the day. Mm-hmm. So there is some availability. I mean, I think we'd always like to have more, but there is some.
Okay. Edie, I'll direct this one to you, and then this will probably be a big issue in our second one as well, the second hour. But can you talk a little bit about the housing first requirement? I mean, this is somewhat controversial in essentially what it's not a model for all that help with the homeless in our community, but explain what it is. And I think you're at the mercy of HUD's funding in that case, but talk a minute what housing first is.
Well, there was a change in requirements from HUD several years ago that basically said, we're going to eliminate all barriers to housing and not require people to have be clean and sober before they can get into housing. So if you're going to take federal money for housing, and actually I think even city money requires this too, that you can't require certain things before they get in. Like, there are just a lot of limitations put on people. So we have what's called barriers-free housing. So we really try to create no limits to somebody to get into housing. Or, for example, once they get in, it used to be if somebody was drinking on premises, we could ask them to leave. Now, really, we try to create no barriers. We try to ensure that somebody can stay in housing as long as possible and try to be successful. Now, granted, there's a time when there may have to be an eviction notice, but I think all of us work very hard to not get to that point.
Go ahead, Kay.
And I will add to that part of the motivation on that was the fact that if you're sleeping under a bridge, you're not thinking about, I wonder if I can quit drinking today. I wonder if I should stop smoking. Those are not the thoughts going through your mind. And they were saying you're going to have much greater success at trying to deal with those issues later on when you know you have a bed, when you know you have meals, you have some kind of stability, and then you're able to go ahead and address what those other barriers are. Those barriers shouldn't stop you from that stability.
Right. What is there some there's problems with that option, though, too. I mean, maybe the community perceives it as a problem, but can you just maybe elaborate a bit more? And we'll get into that even more in the second hour, but I mean,
I just think from a staffing perspective, it's sure a lot easier to say if somebody's drinking, they're out. That's really clear, and there's no gray area. So it's a challenge to get people to work with other folks to learn, okay, let's try to find some other strategies that might help them stay here. Maybe it's a different staff person. Maybe it's a different referral. Maybe it's another location. So it's not as black and white as it used to be before Housing First came into place, but I do think we're actually much more successful because we have to be resilient and flexible and creative, and I think it's important for us to do that.
With your transitional housing programs, how has that worked into the neighborhoods that you're in? I mean, I know that neighborhood up on Northwest Boulevard where you built the small cottage, but you have several other units. But how do the neighbors react to that? Has that been issues or?
Yeah, so early on, building the cottages was a challenge. A lot of people thought that 2 acres of land was a publicly owned park. So when we were saying we were building on it, they were very offended that we were taking away their park. They didn't know that we owned the property. So that was one complexity to it. And I think, you know, there is this thing that you kind of got to about they're poor people, and that has lots of stereotypes to it, that they're going to not be respectful of their space. And so just continuing to work with the neighborhood council, with the neighbors, meeting with them every time there was a complaint, meeting with the cop shop, just staying in front of people and answering their questions. And, you know, it's not perfect. Things are going to happen, but things are going to happen in my neighborhood too. So I don't know why we somehow create differences about this population.
Right. Hey, I think what I'll do, we've got about 5 minutes. I think this is a pretty good question. I think I'll go around with all four of you and ask this, you know, the general question is, what is Spokane doing similarly or different from other large cities in terms of this? And their question is, what is the most successful? But I would also ask, what would, if you had a wish list, let's say unlimited financing maybe, what kind of things would you say, you know, just like we want a wish list here, what kind of things would you like to improve overall? We've got about 5 minutes. I'll let you guys just take it from there with that.
Well, I think we'd probably all agree with we need more low affordable housing. We need case management for those that need the case management. A lot more money would be good because we can do a lot of different things with that. But as far as not necessarily fixing the problem, but really taking a big dent out of it is getting that low affordable housing available with the least amount of barriers possible with the landlords and those that hold those leases. And then obviously, and kind of what you were just speaking to, we have to meet the person where they're at, and we say that all the time, but it's important to focus on that, because once you do that, then you can start working on getting them or supporting them getting to a place that they need to be to get into permanent supported housing.
Okay.
And I guess I'd say it's kind of ancillary to that, because I agree with you, but issues like bus passes are so challenging, and I know that the city just approved $30,000 for that, but you know, that's gone in no time. Just getting people around from place to place, and then affordable childcare. We ask people to try to get to a point where they can pull themselves out of poverty, but then they often a first job is in the evening or weekends, and finding childcare for their children is really challenging. So I think until we really tackle the childcare issue, we're not gonna really be able to address some of these other things.
Yeah.
And I would add on, I mean, obviously we need SCADs more housing, and that means we need SCADs more money to make that. So that's the dream. But one of the things that if I had the magic wand to wave, I would also look at how do we extend the services that we have so that someone who's getting back on their feet doesn't, you know, they've now gotten a job and they are stable and things are going well and, oh, you make too much money, I'm sorry, you're out of our program. They have to start all over because now they have to go back and find someplace else to rent, which we already know they can't. And is that homelessness that we are now creating going to put them back in the beginning of the cycle and start it all over again because they aren't stable, they can't get to work, and starts the whole thing over? So I would really like to see a more sliding scale of some kind that as they become stable, it's not a cutoff. It's a much nicer, kinder handoff into I'm now out on my own and able to sustain my own life, and that space becomes available for someone else to be doing things, as opposed to, oh great, you make too much money, it's time for you to go.
Okay, and Dr. Lutz, we've only got about a minute. Do you have some ideas too? No, that's fine. That's fine. Don't worry.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just in summary, for me, I like to talk about the prevention, because again, I think we've talked a lot about the need to address the problem, but until we really start looking upstream and really addressing the root issues, then we're going to continue to look for more funding and more housing and more of these resources that we know are few and far between. So if there's ways for us to collectively come together and say this is a collective approach to a systemic problem that requires all of us to be involved, then I think we can start looking at solutions, long-term solutions that will hopefully prevent this from being a recurrent problem.
Okay, great. I think we're going to close it out there. We would like to thank you all for listening to part one of our panel discussion, Confronting Homelessness with Spokane Public Radio. And thanks to our first panel members, Tim Sigler, Kay Morano, Edie Rice Sauer, and Bob Lutz, as well as our special guest, Loretta Graycloud, who shared her story of homelessness. We would also like to thank City Cable 5 and our engineer, Jay Nordling, also our event donors, Numerica Credit Union, the Journal of Business, and Providence Healthcare.